You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
New Year's Day, the President's Palace now just being called the White House. Informally, because of the post-war paint job. It began at 11:30. The women were ushered in the cabinet, wives including Louisa Adams, the wife of John Quincy. They made their bows to Miss Monroe, the First Lady. Harrison Gray Otis called these events put on by the Monroes in the White House the most amusing, fatiguing, squeezing ceremonies to be imagined. No cards, civilians mixed with diplomats and Washingtonians, sometimes Indian delegations would add a flair to these events. Trays of wines and ice cubes went through the crowd. These more formal occasions at the White House were a change from Jefferson and Madison's Republican plain vanilla virtues. But Monroe had been ambassador and traveled the world, and he knew Washington was becoming a laughingstock. None of the ambassadors wanted to come. He wanted the federal capital to be more formal, for the presidency to be taken seriously. At this time, it was up to the president to decorate the house, their own furniture. This president could do so very well. He had been ambassador to France, and the Monroes had some great Louis XVI brass inlaid furniture, including Empire gilt chairs with crimson satin adorned with gold eagles. This reflected the style of James Monroe, the Republican president who knew how to party like a Federalist. He liked these occasions, and they weren't all stuffy. He enjoyed a good joke with his sometimes rival Henry Clay and his ribald humor. Once, when a bad wine from South America came in, Clay joked, "It should have been sent with the president's message on South America. It was worth as much." Guests were appalled. You can't joke like that at the White House. But Monroe cracked up.
History stories, and I've been trying to tell them as best I can for now 15 years to provide you with more context when you pursue your politics. It's not a perfect solution. One guy talking, one guy doing research, doing the best he can, but it works, I think. And there are other people starting to do it now too, or always really were. In that last story, in addition to getting a sense of flair and a little bit of how parties change over time, even way back in the early 1800s, as a Republican president tries to get a little bit Federalist, you also see a story of executive power and a congressional challenge to that executive power in a light way. Yes, 15 years of my history can beat up your politics, started with an enormous Dell desktop thing that hummed, and I had to take the sound of that hum out, and a Radio Shack microphone that made me sound weird, and a silly little intro that went on too long. Thank you for joining me for some or all of that journey. And if you're new and you're just kind of listening for the first time, hey, this is going to be a little more retrospective episodes. If you go to Apple Podcasts right now and please subscribe, I got a whole bunch of episodes there too. Today I'm going to do something different. I'm going to talk to two listeners. Both of them have been listeners since 2007. I'll talk to Kevin Willis about history and to Tom Morris about history and the movies and his movie podcast, The Good, The Bad, and The Nerdy. Oh, and we're very soon going to have Richard Bay of The Richard Bay Show, who is a fan of the podcast, and he's going to come on, and I'm talking to him soon. A few clips, though, from previous shows. Here's one that I always keep in mind. I was trying to answer a person who challenged me in a good way to answer, like, what does it matter what the founders thought? When we're talking about politics today, and I think the time he asked the question was 2010, what does it matter what Washington or Franklin thought about this? And we have Google, we have smartphones now. I don't entirely disagree with his point, but I thought that you should still consider, you know, a founder's opinion should only be one article of a debate, certainly, one consideration. But how do you express that right? And I remember I was walking in a park on a guided tour of some obscure parts of Manhattan, New York City, that people don't normally go to, where there's trees and even caves. And there was one tree in particular the tour guide talked about.
One of these areas is Inwood Park, still exists today at the northern end of Manhattan. And the fellow that was giving us a tour mentioned that there was a particular tree which can survive a long time, and this tree was 250 years old, and that where this tree stood was where the Hessians chased down the army of the Patriots that would join up with the army of George Washington coming from southern Manhattan, you know, originally from Brooklyn, to cross at the Hudson River into New Jersey and begin a retreat. The tree is 250 years old. Now, we are not trees, but it puts things in some kind of a perspective to have some organic object, a living thing, is as old as these guys were, that was around at the time that Washington was a Revolutionary War general.
Does it make you think one way or other about the question presented? No, it doesn't have to. I tell stories also to provide a human side of the history, like this one.
Here's where I have to be frank. Lyndon Johnson was a bully. If you had to deal with him, he was a jerk. He was a guy that if we knew him personally, if we had to deal with him in our job, God forbid, if we had to work for him, we would think all of those negative things. But because he was those things, more people could vote and seniors got health care. But he would not be fun to work for. Just ask the former Kennedy aides who began working for Johnson's administration, and then, when they wanted to quit, Johnson threatened to draft them into the army if they left his administration. Or his helicopter pilot. In the book, Inside the President's Helicopter, Reflections of a White House Senior Pilot. Great book, authored by Army Lieutenant Colonel Gene Boyer. He's actually the pilot who flew Richard Nixon home after his resignation. Boyer makes it clear in his book that although he came from a family of Democrats, supported the Democratic Party, he didn't think much of Lyndon Johnson as president. A drinker and a phony, he said. Ordered all kinds of crazy assignments. Treated the copter pilots like dirt. Moved the copter command to his ranch. You may not want to be his plumber, who he badgered until his showerhead water pressure was that of a fire hose, the way LBJ liked it. Or ask Bill Moyers, who was scolded by LBJ for missing a statistic in a Medicare speech. Nor is it any better if you were a cabinet secretary or even a vice president working for Lyndon Johnson.
And the point's not to slam Lyndon Johnson, not at all, but also to say that he got a lot done as president. It's just there's a trade-off. He had more legislative experience than any person, anybody recently, save Gerald Ford, and he had more than Ford. But without delay, because I'm going to talk about presidents with Kevin Willis. Willis is a longtime listener and history fan from the beginning. By the way, who thinks, like I do, that with his voice he should have his own podcast? Kevin Willis. Kevin, you've been, as far as I know, you're one of the longest listeners of the show.
Yeah, I mean, I think you had 9 episodes. Something like that.
Oh, that's great. Well, you kept listening, so we must have been doing something good.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, some of your later stuff, your Ronald Reagan series was awesome. I loved that.
I felt like a couple of things were going on there. One is that if you remember the initial My History Can Beat Up Your Politics, it's like a lot of little topics. I had to like address an issue in like 20 minutes, half hour. And I felt I was doing so much of that that I was losing, like, whereas a historian, a traditional one, will start reading books and doing research and stuff, getting deep on things. I was losing some of that over time. And I'm like, uh-oh, if I don't start delving into something, I don't have any anchors anymore. So, like, I picked a few topics, one of which is the, which I'll surprise people one day with. It is a whole history of the Soviet Union, particularly the fall of it, which I haven't aired. It's been in notepads and legal things since 2013. But Reagan was another one.
Yeah, Reagan was awesome. The Arc of Commerce was an excellent series. I really enjoyed that. I have I like history, and I like that sort of vertical run on just specifically on American history via the arc of commerce. That was really, really interesting. It takes this little slice of life, but a critical one, and follows it all the way through. I was planning on re-listening to that again sometime soon.
You'll probably put it all together to make it easier for people on a page. I just felt that was one where I felt very strongly that here we are talking history, and this is something that I guess is a kernel. You get these little kernels from things during an argument about representation, corporate personhood, say. One of the lines that somebody said is, well, what do you want, the legislature to be nothing but activists? I mean, if you don't let any corporate interest in, all it's going to be is ever, it's like if you, business becomes the forbidden voodoo. Nice little, you know, more from the right side of things. And it's like, yeah. And then that led me to thought, my God, you know, there's also a whole life. Most people in the history we're talking about worked somewhere, did business.
That is correct. And if if the business just will not just become a forbidden voodoo, if it has any option, it will become activist itself. And
that's true too. You probably see some funded. You already see that, like some AstroTurf groups would just secretly find ways to. It'll never leave, I guess, and that's what you learn doing the arc. That these people, you know, Henry David Thoreau made pencils. Okay, so I didn't even plan that one. It evolved. You know, Reagan was planned. I knew exactly what the episodes were gonna be. Well, I did adjust a little. When Trump came in, I had to adjust and have an episode 9 called Shockwave, because there were way too many quotes. The best was Springsteen, who in both elections, Bruce Springsteen says in a concert, man, I just don't know what to say about this election. And then like pretty close to that, he says it in 2016. Man, I don't know what to say about this election. So I'm like, you know, going back, I said, I got to do one on the shockwave of just having this crazy new president, which people thought Reagan at the time was. And certainly, as a candidate and the way he came off, you even see more of it now with the tape of him and Nixon. And, you know, there's some argument to be made there that he wasn't that there. You know, as a president and as a kind of his demeanor as a person, a lot different than, say, Trump.
A story of one day in the Reagan administration illustrates this. Tip O'Neill talks about a meeting in the White House where a bipartisan group was discussing unemployment. Tip O'Neill mentioned that the rate was 7%, still too high. Reagan then said that it would be lower if the army was counted. Well, O'Neill shrugged and said, well, that's true, but it's always been true. Then Reagan said, those people can find jobs if they really want to. For O'Neill, it was symptomatic. He was getting steamed, Reagan went on. I'm told about the fellow on welfare who makes calls looking for work. On the third call, they offer him a job, and he hangs up. O'Neill is now livid, and everyone in the room can see. Don't give me that crap. The guy in Youngstown, Ohio, who's been laid off at the steel mill and has to make his mortgage payments. Your stories might work on your rich friends. Not on us. Don't tell me he doesn't want to work. Reagan is a little bit shocked. Stammers a bit. Senator Alan Simpson at this point jumps in and asks them not to bicker. This can't do. You're the Speaker of the House. You're the leader of the free world. You two are always bickering. Sorry, O'Neill said. I just can't sit here and listen to him talk like this. I don't want my silence to be regarded as acquiescence. I have nothing but respect for the presidency. And then Reagan said, with the exception of this incumbent. O'Neill said he left that meeting, stormed out, angry at a man who was so blind to the suffering of so many people. It was Reagan at his worst, he would write later. And then, shortly after the meeting, the Challenger space shuttle exploded. 7 astronauts were lost. And the president went onto television.
The crew of the space shuttle Challenger honored us for the manner in which they lived their lives. We will never forget them, nor the last time we saw them this morning, as they prepared for their journey and waved goodbye and slipped the surly bonds of earth to touch the face of God. Thank you.
O'Neill was watching, and he said of the man who he had just had this argument with, "As I listened to him, I had a tear in my eye and a lump in my throat."
The arc was totally a growth. It probably was going to be three originally and turned into what it was. I have all these Edison interviews that are missing. I never got a chance to put them in. It's a whole interview with Edison. And one of the things that's interesting about him is that he never considered himself a scientist. He was an inventor, and he used science in a very practical way. And if it didn't do something or make something, he didn't care. And that was a fascinating comment by somebody who you'd think would be scientists would love and revere and everything like that.
How many episodes do you think the Soviet Union will be?
If I ever start that, the first thing I'm going to need to do is an expert.
Oh, you have to start.
Yeah, I have to start. I think it's going to be the 2022 project. I'm starting to give myself a project, you know. And it'll be like anything else. It'll be, I got to do a little behind the paywall and then bring it out later. Fortunately, with the advertising, speaking of Ark and Commerce, and nobody likes advertising, but one thing advertising has done is maybe I won't have to do that because I don't have to hide things. I won't have to do it very long. But anyway, I didn't answer the question. So number of episodes, there's so much because I start with a truck rolling down a road in the Russian, I guess it was fall. And what you find out later is that truck is filled with restraints that could be used to hold back people. And that was ordered during the coup of Gorbachev. And one of the things I want to get to, in addition to the way of telling the whole history of the late Soviet Union, the fall of the Soviet Union, is that, it came a lot closer than what people think. You know, Yeltsin was almost a lucky break, and a lot of brave people. And the opposite in Russia, as what we had in China at Tiananmen Square, in other words, when they sent the tanks in from the hinterland into Moscow, those guys would not fire on Russians. Where in China, when they called the tanks from Beijing, would not fire on Beijing citizens in Tiananmen Square. But when they called the tanks from their hinterlands, they turned the cameras off, but I think we're all pretty clear what happened there. And that's two different outcomes. So in telling that story about how close we came with the coup and the events of the coup, I'm going to digress into explaining things that then give you the history of what life was like in the Soviet Union. Good and bad, and I have a lot of it. I have it from Kremlinologists from the U.S., and some of them made mistakes, but some of them did well. A couple of books by journalists who went in there. I think Hendrik Smith. I think I have it right. I hope I didn't. Yeah, Hendrik Smith. Some great comments and observations, some Russian authors, some newspapers, and then a Quora where a lot of Russians who lived in the Soviet Union were actually willing to talk a bit about it. So it's, there's going to be some good stuff. I guess this functions as a mini preview for it, so I'm talking on and on. So fine, now I really have to do it.
That's you do have to do it.
You've been a listener so long, you get it then. I am going to get a professor to help on that one because I have Ben Sawyer, who is from the Road to Now podcast, is an expert, and he also hooked me up with another person who can be helpful, really good at how the economy worked, because you had the secret economy. That was, by the way, the GDP behind that secret economy in the Soviet Union was one of the most powerful economies of the 80s, and nobody really knows that.
I had no idea.
It bought cars. It bought foreign goods. I mean, mostly it was domestic. But still, the size of the economy would rival countries at that time. And there was so much capitalism going on in the Soviet Union, a lot of it them looking the other way, despite a large police presence. There's all these things we need to think about. Looking at the Soviet Union could make us feel better. I know people on the right of politics would be the first to jump on that particular thing. And it's not terribly far from the truth, because there's such buffoonery that went on when you eliminate the free market and things like that. Mm-hmm. There's crime and things like that that go hand in hand with it. And there's corruption and inefficiency It also, though, is a warning about a military state, because at the essence, the Soviet Union was a military state. And one has to watch. We love our veterans. I will be the first, of course, to say that. When they enter politics, they should be as subject to criticism as anyone else, maybe with a little bit of, hey, let's cut the guy a little bit of slack. He spent a lot of time in the military. You don't want to make what John Glenn's opponent, his mistake of saying, oh, you didn't have a job, when John Glenn was like in the Air Force and an astronaut. And he's like, excuse me, and lost that primary. But you also have to watch giving too much credence, because that's exactly what happened after World War II. There's such heroism that anyone who was, you know, that status was used. And Soviet Union never lost its kind of military society. And I don't think people often think of it that way, because you think of it like, how crazy, how could something like that happen here? And the only one pathway people see is maybe through leftist and protest signs. But there is another pathway, and that was probably closer to the sustainability of the Soviet Union in the 30s. And that's more of a military society. You have to watch out for that, too. Where, you know.
Well, that is an answer to my question. I can tell how animated you are by the topic. I feel certain you will deliver, at least in 2022.
Yeah, I mean, I was on a first class flight in 2013 that was grounded, and I remember copying notes. That was 2013, so I have there's a whole book there.
The United States was of Athens, and we were of Sparta, said one Russian to the author Hendrik Smith. It was a society on heightened alert, with enemies declared or not. We know World War II. For them, it was the war, or the Great Patriotic War. Americans, in their perception, just helped. Soviet Union, Soviet citizens lost giant, heart-wrenching numbers. There were many more females in the Soviet Union and older females in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, because a male generation had been almost wiped out with the Great Patriotic War. Heart-wrenching numbers. 20 millions of people died. It's known in the United States as a stat in a textbook, but it's not that kind of double known, that kind of real known. Only World War II forged what Soviet Union was, and some inkling of what Russia is today, cementing farmers, workers, party members, even the destroyed Orthodox Church was revived as an important patriotic organ during the war and survived through the fall of the Soviet Union. Lots of statues and military equipment, old rocket launchers, armored vehicles from World War II, the vehicle itself being the monument. And yes, you may see a bride and groom posing next to that military equipment, taking pictures next to tanks or rocket launchers. Oh, yes. Don't get carried away. They still took photos in the traditional scenic places, lakes and forests and all. But the best photo for a wedding, the photo the couple just had to take, was next to a lovely green tank, a symbol of the patriotic struggle. After that, well, a visit to the Palace of Weddings, the name implying the role of government, which was ever present in life. Palace of Weddings. After which, through many a Russian street, many a toast to the bride. Oh, you'd better just do that. Not doing it would be like stepping on the American flag. Then after a dirty look, after you did what you were supposed to do, a dirty look from the groom, toast the bride. You would carefully switch gears and offer a second toast to all the women of the Soviet Union. And your tension with the hulky groom momentarily mitigated. You would switch as they snapped photos of the bride and groom in front of a rocket launcher, a tank, a transport carrier. Who cares? It's still so romantic.
But it's still not finished, because it's going to end with the resolution of the coup. But in the middle, you're going to get Russian culture from Russians and their perspective. And, you know, you and Americans are like a Disneyland and all of this stuff. I love it. But in the middle and in the end, I mean, we're going to resolve what actually happened with that coup. And I would say a warning of how close that really came if they weren't buffoons and didn't make a few mistakes.
I'm Jane Perlez. longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Do you remember, it was in the 80s sometime, and I believe it was like a kind of a 24-hour television trade between us and the Soviet Union, where a selected network or networks broadcast for 24 hours Soviet television, and so they did the same thing in the Soviet Union. And I remember I watched a lot of that television that day. It was very interesting.
You know, I don't recall the specifics. Of course, I recall things that they didn't like you know, our America with Robert Urich, the miniseries. And they Soviet Union bought that to show on their TV so that they could show how horribly we were being portrayed. But they were doing some of the same to us. Like, for instance, there was a whole miniseries and that was popular in Russia about how we negotiated secretly with the Germans to end the war quicker. But it didn't happen. Well, at least I don't know that it happened. And it's not part of any history I've ever been made aware of, and that at their expense. And that's something that just got a lot of traction as a conspiracy theory in the Soviet Union and you know, didn't fuel good relations, among other things.
I should mention how I originally came to your podcast, because while I may not remember the specific year, I remember what I was looking for, which was I wanted exactly your podcast. I was surprised to find it, actually. One that made a point of history and its relevance to politics when so much of contemporary political discussion tends to be very focused on the moment, as if we just discovered everything yesterday and that there's no history to reference. And I was a big believer at the time, still am, that historical trends were very significant and very informative. Whereas a lot of times people would say, oh, you know, this party or that party is going to go be wandering in the wilderness for 40 years. You know, it's going to be all Democrats or all Republicans for the next 40 years. And it just almost never happens. There's, you know, the Democrats held on to the House for 40 years. But that, I thought, was more of an anomaly, was in part because half the Democrats were, you know, could have caucused with the Republicans at the time.
And they did, and they would easily provide cover for many Eisenhower or Nixon policies. And no Republican president feared being able to not being able to use the Democratic Congress when they needed, with a few exceptions. A speaker could call a party line vote, and then you were in trouble. But just like today with, Manchin. There were several Manchins in the Democratic.
Yeah, there's a lot fewer on both sides in terms of, you know, who the other party can rely on in certain circumstances based on the, you know, nature of the constituency and what their needs are. Things have, I feel, have been a lot more nationalized. It's there's fewer politicians even in the House that are going to say, well, you know, this is not my party's position, but I know this is what the voters in my district want. There's a lot more of trying to make a national appeal and be a national politician, even though technically you're supposed to be representing the voters of your district.
It is truer in America that we set everything up to not have that virtual representation. We were aware of that concept and that the English had, or the British Parliament, I should say, had, that it was Yes, I only represent a manor that's about the size of your average apartment building in Cincinnati or something, but I represent all of England, Scotland, and Wales, by being in this parliament. I think about the country, and to some extent, it's true. Some of those rich folks, their families were in there so long that they didn't care about their little manor. They really did care about the whole country. And some of the funny thing is some of the American Whigs that some of the Whigs that supported America during the revolution were from some of these country estates are like, this is terrible. What are you doing to these guys? You know, this is a bad decision. But, you know, I do want to say something about what you said earlier. I'm glad that you said that. And I approached the podcast when I started it with that exact thing. I am not apolitical completely. I believe in politics. I was unhappy, let's say, with the Iraq War. Let's generally say with the way it was handled. I probably didn't like the origin, but I might be willing to trade that if it worked out. I could have been fine to agree to disagree in things, but that, especially given how it worked out and how little I feel political consequence there was for Bush. In fact, I see these rankings of presidents and Bush is right there in the middle, and I'm not sure why there's not more of that. But in the UK, Tony Blair can hardly sign books without getting, you know, tomatoes thrown at him, and Bush, we don't see as much of that. Okay. But you start looking at the history of things, and it is the first effect is kind of an aspirin, I think. And then the second is you can still have your political issues. Like if I were in the chair, though, I'd still do things this way, but it does temper everything. You know, the first lesson is, has this happened before? And usually it's yes. There was some between 2016 and really even now, there's some challenge to that. And I've always said, there can be new events. It's not like everything's exactly like happened in history. But the real question is, and the question was during the last 4 years too, is like, yeah, but is history still a guide? And if it's not, then we got to hang our hats up. But the answer is yes, it still is useful, even if you're not finding these exact parallels.
Well, it's interesting. Yeah, it's interesting to find, you know, just in case like the 2020 election, where a lot of the trends you say typically would predict what the election outcome would be, don't, you know, and then you get, okay, well, what has changed now? You know, these bellwethers weren't actually bellwethers this time. What's kind of different here? Was it COVID? Was it something else? Was it just how abrasive Trump was? It's just kind of interesting to think. And what does that mean, you know, come 2024 and 2028? It's just interesting to see. But I was, to finish my story real quickly about finding your podcast, I was in the midst of arguing about Ross Perot being a spoiler with some other people I knew, and kind of documenting it. And that got me thinking, you know, that because my argument was all about historical trends, how the incumbent tended to win unless there was a credible third party challenge, unless certain other factors were there. If the party in power had just gotten the White House back, that sort of thing. And I was like, you know, there's got to be someone else talking about this, you know, this kind of thing. You know, what's always tended to happen in terms of, you know, historical trends and the general public acting as a kind of responsive. While everyone has their own political issues, there tends to be, you know, after, you know, two terms in power, three terms in power, it's like, oh, we're sick of the guy at the top, you know, and things tend to change. And with the exception of, again, the Democratic Congress for 40 years, that tends to be the larger pattern of people saying, okay, kind of not necessarily throw all the bums out, but tending to do things that shift the balance of power, or at least seem to, in terms of the labels on the people who are in control.
Yeah, I think, and there, those trends are useful. All, really, any political consultant that's good is looking at trends. They're looking at history. It may be a short period of history. Journalism gets better. Some people try. Some people do it badly. Using history too much. That's why I think when one exercises it, you have to be careful. It should be changing you as much as you're trying desperately. I really want to win this argument. It really should be changing you. If you're not finding that enough, you probably aren't doing it right. Like, even in the, when I started and I was angry at W. Bush or whatever, and, you know, and I could just do a podcast talking about him. And but I was often in any discussion with people said, the reason this is important, because there's a history here. During the Civil War, blah, 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 blah. And I remember doing something about his use of the media, kind of misleading the New York Times into printing something or what have you. And until I, you know, started looking, oh, like, oh, crap, well, it looks like TR did it. Oh, well, Linky did it too. Okay, so, you know, oh, he just destroyed a press that he didn't like, and it wasn't in the South. So, okay, we got, you know, so there's...
Yeah, John Adams, Woodrow Wilson.
Yeah, I mean, so now, I mean, I've done a much more even developed, and some of the recent episodes are kind of extensions of what I did before with more information. I'm definitely more of a researcher and a worker at it than a someone just sitting here with knowledge. You know, although I picked up a few things along the road, but I'm not. You know, so those early episodes, God bless you for sitting through them, because I think they're still good. I argue with myself a few times.
Yeah, but your later episodes where you pick a theme, you know, because you talk like you research and then you share the knowledge, but you often come up with a interesting theme, just like you mentioned about your Plain Soviet Union podcast, mm-hmm. how you handled the episodes of the Reagan podcast and mm-hmm. the Art of Commerce. It makes it, it adds a lot of value to the depiction of history. You know, you're not just relaying the story. You are highlighting things. You are casting a particular light, a focus on, you know, a certain arc through the history you're talking about. And I think that is often as informative, if not more informative, than just the full historical story you might get in a book that's just relaying all the details of everything that happened.
I mean, it's a choice, and I paid a price. I don't mean to sound so terrible about it, because it's fine. It is what it's the choice. But there's a little bit of a price. If I were one that wanted to be, and I did talk to Wondery at a point in 2017, if I wanted to be one of these huge ones or whatever, you really have to decide that you're just going to do history, because history, just stories about it, it actually can offend people. Do you see the reviews on some of those podcasts that just do history? But you know, it's generally it's less offensive. You're just telling a story about this or that. But I made a conscious decision to actually straddle. And then, yes, the modeling of the political issue must affect, like, how you're viewing, why am I even talking about this is question to answer. I have this, I'm doing one soon on airline deregulation, and I have to address that in some part in minute 12 is, you know, oh, by the way, why am I even talking about this? Why do you care? And then that modeling changes the view, the prism by which you view the history, perhaps. But there is a price, because, like, for instance, for the longest time, I've been not winning in history and not winning in news. You know, like in the early going, I could straddle and win in both categories a bit. Now I noticed it's like the specialists have come in, and just the great number of podcasts. Who knew?
There's so many.
Oh, Dolly Parton and Bruce Springsteen and Obama.
Yes, would I have to make that choice between Bruce Carlson and Dolly Parton? It's a struggle.
I wouldn't even be upset. If, you know, that's one, I wouldn't be upset, or, you know, or you're allowed Bob Dylan too. Well, that's a good question for you. What else do you listen to besides me?
Big fan of the Thomas Jefferson Hour. It's Clay Jenkinson. And quite frankly, I know he does actually, he's often out of character talking about history, putting things in context. I really prefer the episodes where he's Thomas Jefferson answering questions. I find those to be the most enlightening and the most interesting, and I think he does a really good job at that. I listen to a number of conservative podcasts, like Commentary with John Podhoretz, and mm-hmm. Also Ricochet, because I like the folks who are more calm generally. Congressional Dish is
she does a great job.
Yeah, she doesn't like the Congress most of the time, but she does a great job of her coverage. And past that, it's mostly just audiobooks. And like I say, you are my primary source of history in last 6 years at least. So it's because work and life just keep me busy. And it's kind of like I just want to keep, keep a toe in, paying attention, listening to someone who, and that's again why I like how you format your podcast, because it's something that I can follow, I can get my mind around, where I can remember and kind of understand the context you're putting things in. And I just typically love your subject matter. The minute you said airline deregulation, I'm like, oh, that's for me.
Gosh, I hope there's a 100 Nation Army out there that feels the same way. To hear you saying this is interesting to me, because sometimes, especially in the beginning, when there was less even interaction, and I have a Facebook and other things, but, I did get the sense, like, I'm just talking to a microphone. I think like any DJ radio, we all have that. But podcasts are a great way to do exactly what you're saying. For instance, one I listen to is Entitled Opinions. And Entitled Opinions comes out of, it's actually a college radio show that put on a podcast. And I can't remember the fellow's name, but it's Entitled Opinions, comes out of Stanford. He talks about philosophy, a lot of complicated art, a lot of philosophy behind politics, Heidegger and Nietzsche and things like this. And not stuff normally, if I was opening a book at this point, I would fall asleep, but I can keep up with it a little with a podcast. Yeah. And if I can do that, great.
I don't mean to keep bringing up future podcasts you haven't done yet, but on the deregulation of the airlines, it's always been kind of my position that there's always a lot of pain in deregulating, particularly an industry that's been largely nationalized, because they've been hothouse flowers for so long that they're not prepared or equipped to work in the market the way an Apple or a Google or a Walmart is. And so, and there's a lot of struggle in terms of either quality or price or just service generally. And I've always felt the airlines suffered a lot from that. And they also suffer a lot in downtimes, because when the market dries up, they don't have that backing support that they used to in terms of management and, in just general sense that, the government kind of has a hand in here. There's a steady, right. They're helping keep the industry afloat, and they felt an obligation because the airlines were so regulated.
Yeah. And I mean, one of the things that's crazy, but one of the reasons it even passed is that, they didn't have a lobbying force, and the union associated didn't have. Why would they keep a lobbying on staff? Why would they keep the expense? This isn't going to change. We've been regulated forever. Now the AFL-CIO stepped in with its lobbyists to oppose it, and the airlines eventually got other lobbyists, and they did oppose it. A couple airlines, it was airline deregulation's a little easier because some of the airlines even got it, like United, for instance, supported it because they were like, yeah, we benefit a little from regulation, but this is, first of all, we think these companies are benefiting more. It's a lot of factors there. I think that the airlines did run into that. A lot of them went bankrupt. A lot of the ones that existed then end up going bankrupt, which was what some of what was predicted. And then some of it's just like what you're going to see when you open things up to a free market. I always get in that in the various places I've lived, you see a bank opens up and then another bank opens up next to it. And then there's like a hot dog stand that people liked and it closes and it becomes a bank. And people are like, all these banks. And it's like, yeah, that's that. There's a little bit of the price of the free market because, in other words, one of those three banks is going out of business. But for the moment, you're going to have to pay the price that your hot dog stand went out to see which one will go out of business, see which one does it better. And I've heard the same about like drugstore chains and things like that. But that's some of what happened. Khan, the guy that was Carter's chief regulator, goes to Allegheny Airlines and he says, hey, I'm going to remove the rules. What are you going to do? And they said, oh, we might do this, we might do that or whatever. As soon as deregulation happens, they go and buy these big jets and they're no longer Allegheny Airlines. They want to be a national carrier like everybody else. They want the volume benefits and the larger audience. They don't just want to be an Allegheny's airline. And that can be one of the problems. So there was a little bit of a problem with some of the local services afterwards that might have been protected by regulation. And then there's just a lot of like, okay, now you got a lot of people competing and some of them aren't going to survive. So then you will have a little less competition because some of those don't survive. You start with enormous competition. And so it's and it's a difficult thing to analyze. I probably won't make too much of a judgment about it, but I have several opinions of it and all of that. And that should be coming up probably after this episode. Is there anything else that you've been like, hey, I really been meaning to ask Bruce this or that?
I just want to hear your new podcast. Soviet Union. The airline deregulation. What else is coming up?
Oh, okay. So one of the things is the 1890s. I've been researching and on the Patreon site. Oh, a little plug. www.patreon.com/MHCBUIP for those interested people out there. So I have some of the scrapbook from it. And basically the scrapbook is just exactly what you think. It's me reading the notes. But it turns out, even that, it became kind of interesting to do. And then I had to shape it a little. So it's nice stories, but it's just a basically a little series, not going to be as big as Arc of Commerce or anything like that. Probably be a 2-episode on the American 1890s and everything that happened. And it's such a transformation decade. You know, there was a time when in St. Louis, right in the beginning of the 1890s, you could basically, you know, Mark Twain and others used to take a cup, scoop it in the river, or if you went to a bar there, you'd get a beer and a glass of river water. And they'd even talk about the medicinal properties of it. Like, wow. People from St. Louis loved drinking that water. And it was 1900 when Chicago changed the direction of its river and sent all of that down the Mississippi, and that just ruined the whole thing. But in the 1890s, you were still doing that. That's just one of, I mean, that's a whole decade. What else? I talk about all the attempts to fly, all of the cars being built in the U.S., some poets in there, Walt Whitman dies, you know. And then a lot of political debates happen in the 1890s. The decision that the Gilded Age isn't the way to go is the battle that's fought in the 1890s, even though not everybody wins. You know, Eugene Debs or Bryan don't get their way, but they get a little bit of it in the progressive era that comes afterwards. So, yeah, just a fascinating time, and that's coming up. I actually do have a little bit of a gap I got to fill. I'm like, oh, I'm going to come up with some episodes here.
All right. So ask you a question. I do have one question to ask you, which is, who is your favorite president in your lifetime, and then who's your favorite president before you were born?
Great question. You know, I kind of liked Bill Clinton, maybe because he liked the presidency so much. And it's not to say, I'm not talking about greatest president or ranking.
Yeah.
Because I put him, he's very much in the lower middle, if you ask me. Learned while he was in the office. Here's a good way to think about it. The last president who believed in even trying to meld issues at all between two parties.
Yep.
Because
exactly
after that,
true.
It was like, nope, it's about we win and we get what we want. And that's the game now, you know. But it was at least a guy trying there. You could see the American issues being worked out. Okay, but, you know, that sounds like gushing. I mean, obviously, you know, from the series, there's aspects of Reagan that I think, like, when tax reform's undersold as an accomplishment, that's a huge, that made a huge difference in people's lives that we don't even talk about. His reaching out to Gorbachev and somebody else with less of status. We know because George H.W. Bush almost retreated from that. I think those two things are important. When you look at before, which would have been, I was born, Nixon was my first and not, mm-hmm. not all that long. Boy, you know, there's a lot of presidents. So,
gotta pick one.
This is hard to pick one. But the more I think about it, and it's a lot of unutilized or could have been in this, is that James Garfield starts to stand out to me as somebody who, if he got the full time, might have mm-hmm. made a great president. And that's come from some recent podcasts that I've done and reading some of the books. He was, as one of the books is titled, the last Lincoln Republican. And that perhaps we would have been able to continue some policies or go in a good direction, not too much of the corrupt type Northern Republicans and not giving in too much to the Redeemer governments in the South. That's somebody that I look to.
Hello all, Eric Rivenis with the Most Notorious podcast here. Each week I interview an author or historian about a historical true crime, tragedy, or disaster. Subject matter ranges from gunslingers to Gilded Age murder to gangsters to fires to pirates to wild prison breaks. My guests bring their incredible knowledge directly to you. Please subscribe to Most Notorious on your favorite podcast app. Cheers, and have a safe tomorrow.
But, you know, that's hard just to pick one.
Oh, yeah, I know. But
that's who I'm going
almost
with.
All of them have something redeeming, something fascinating, if not in their politics and in their personality.
Absolutely. I mean, my others to mention, I mean, Grant is there with some failures. Grant is definitely there. Benjamin Harrison had a few more things that I liked about him than I wouldn't put him on that list, though, because he had other failures. And a few more things than I thought. Yeah.
Well, that is interesting. I'm glad to finally have that question answered, because that is one that I did have burning.
You did have burning, well, yeah. So, you know, I haven't done a full ranking, and I don't kind of agree with ranking, but I don't know. I might do one anyway. You know, I have trouble with Carter. There's some things I like, but I can't totally. Some of the complaints are there, too. I addressed that in the deregulation episode. You know, probably a little better with Congress than people say, but he's not better enough to totally make a historical revision. You know,
early on, and particularly the first year or so of Trump's presidency, I commonly made the comparison to Trump and Carter in terms of coming in with an attitude, not working with certain people, you know, being not meeting the expectations of the Congress and the Senate there in terms of being invited, being talked to, being consulted on initiatives, that sort of thing, and having that backfire on them. And I saw there was actually a lot of similarities. I know a lot of people might not make that comparison, but it seemed like
The God complex is there. Well, again, you know, if you asked Jimmy Carter, he never would have said anything like that.
Yes,
or use it as
that's
put
a big
down.
Difference.
But the way, you know, like the I got elected, and this was a bit of a crusade to get elected. And that primary was a miracle. And I think he always felt like that. If he would have looked more to his general election and governed that way, you might have seen a different thing. He only got 50% of the vote and nearly lost it. So that was okay. Reagan ended up beating him. I think Ford could have ended up beating him and coming back if that was in the cards on the Republican nominating side. So I mean, you're right, every president there's like good and bad. Wilson, Nixon, they have these qualities. There's good and then there's awful stuff.
Yeah.
And I think it's to the office. I mean, I listed Clinton as my best, but I mean, there's some awful things there. Biden's doing some good things, but I know that there's people that will disagree or people that want to push harder on things. Both Wilson and Andrew Johnson, even in my own, maybe not my lifetime, but the books that I read that would be on a library shelf, say, you know, still have glorious references to Andrew Johnson and Woodrow Wilson. You know, and that was the theme. But that changes over time.
Do you think if Huey Long had lived, he could have been president?
Well, you see that Trump factor. This is funny because sometimes politics informs history. I think that really, that's a good way to end. Like, politics informs history, too. So when I see that and see how much, when you have a fan base like that, primaries become obstacles you can just swarm over. I remember in 2015 thinking, like, yeah, this Trump, he's got name recognition, but he's not going to, you know. Andrew Yang tried to run for New York City mayor. I mean, name recognition, shoots up in the polls, then shoots right down. I mean, maybe that would happen with Trump. Well, this is interesting. This is funny. But that fan base and that group, that can storm over politics. And I know, you know, he was claiming that he put FDR in office. And if he wasn't shot, he probably would have primaried FDR. Now, maybe you don't win that, but what about 1940? Yeah. I mean, It's first of all, I think he could have gotten FDR run for the money in 1936 in various primaries. FDR would have had to go south to the more conservative Southerners. So in any case, he would have changed politics greatly. Because I think Huey Long is going to be here running like, every man a king, very liberal program. And FDR is going to have no choice but to be protected by some South Carolina. And wouldn't be primaries at that point. It would be just getting votes probably from the major figures. And so he would have had to defend against Long. He would have had to become more conservative and there would have been less to the New Deal. Or I guess you could argue he could have accelerated things even more. It's hard to say. But I think if it's a party contest, an FDR, great control of those machines. A chance, and if it happens, it's probably 1940. And it's probably maybe the Republicans had to either support him or do some kind of coalition. Like, we won't run a candidate or we don't really care about our candidate, vote Long. Just to get FDR out.
That is an amazingly detailed answer.
It could be wrong. It's great. Well, hey, Kevin, this has been great. Thanks for coming on My History Could Beat Up Your Politics after being a listener for so long.
Oh, you're more than welcome. This has been awesome. Thanks a lot.
I talk now to Tom Morris. He has a podcast, The Good, The Bad, and The Nerdy, and he's been a listener for a long time, since 2007, and has been very active on Fans of My History Can Beat Up Your Politics on Facebook over the years. If you haven't joined that and you want to, and you're on Facebook, Fans of My History Can Beat Up Your Politics, search for it.
Hi, Tom.
Hey.
This is Bruce Carlson. Well, I guess you know my voice.
Thanks for having me on.
I'm happy to do so.
And, one of the things I love about, always said about your podcast is you ground it down on history to explain why the politics is this specific way. I always tell people, listen to your show because it makes so much more sense to a lot of people. They just don't understand because really nobody really does properly read the history.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. Yep. Are they using the part because they want to get to their argument first, which is a human temptation, and I am not immune to it. I have politics. I have policy preferences, of course. They do get tapered a bit when you start to look at history and like, well, they tried this and it didn't work. They tried this and it didn't work. Like, no one's ever going to agree to this, so it's not going to work even if it works as a theoretical. And you start doing that and you do get less angry.
Congress used to literally fight each other on the floor. So, I mean, we could talk about like how bad Congress is now. It's like, it's different. They actually would physically stab each other if they could.
But I love, and I've always, what I love about doing this is that you get to, you can do like a little bit of Paul Harvey, like more to the story. Like, and
absolutely.
I used to listen to him. And what?
Now the rest of the story.
The rest of the story. It's like the guy that beat the other one with the cane. I'm going to make it really quick. I love the fact that I was able to research and find that he was later challenged to a duel by another congressman. But that congressman was so excellent with the weapons, and you get to choose your weapon, and he said rifles, and they were like, "Do not." This Anson, no, I forget his last name, but do not take him on a Burlingame. Do not take Anson Burlingame on with rifles. You'll be, and so he had to demur out of it and then lost a lot of like what he had built up. And he ended up dying like the next year anyway. You know, I forget that.
Andrew Jackson, notorious dueler too. So it's, I always find it hilarious people don't talk about that. Him and John Severio, the general and first governor of Tennessee, they got into multiple almost duels, and people kept pulling away because John Severio usually had weapons on him. Andrew Jackson, however, like just threatened duel with his cane.
yeah, I love the. I talked about that like I think in one of them where it's like. They didn't have the same presidential protection, but in the case of Jackson, you had to protect people from the president, because if you came at him, he was going to beat you with his cane. But in any case, I'm glad we don't do as much of that anymore, even though I could see it. We're not without
those
problems. I'm
sure Hamilton has got some people thinking, this might not be a bad idea.
So, well, this is great because... So I'll ask you this then. Have you, obviously, have you enjoyed this cast over time? Have you, evolution,
always
noticed things?
I mean, I'm a history buff. I mean, my degree's political science. I love the fact that you break everything down. You know, I may not like Reagan, but I love the fact you spend all those episodes detailing all the details about Reagan. You know, I love that you can, look at what's going on in this particular presidential election and show how cycles, as I've always told, history does repeat itself because people don't pay attention. Even the ones who were alive to when it last happened, they don't seem to realize these things constantly do happen. And, when something different does happen, it surprises so many people that it's like, well, I guess you didn't look at what happened 50 years ago, or because it's like, nobody really does in the large sizes understand what they've done or what they're doing.
Yeah, I think that's the whole reason for the starting. I was telling Coven I used to get to do more political talks, and you just find myself getting angry. And it's like, well, if you look a little bit at the history, you still might be angry. You start to get angry over what happened to some historical figures, Still think I think they should have impeached Johnson. That would have, impeached Johnson, put Ben Wade in, and then impeach Ben Wade eventually, but let him solve the problem of Reconstruction in the meantime. I don't know. Time machine, we can play that game.
But I mean, it's the same thing. Like, should they have, if they tried to have killed him at all, then we would have, eventually if Seward had gotten in charge, who knows how it would have gone. It's like, there's certain, I don't think anyone involved understood how, things would go once Lincoln was assassinated. And it's, with Johnson taking over, it was a complete mess because Johnson really should have been vice president to begin with.
Absolutely true. As a vice presidential ticket holder, he performed his function of, helping the ticket. But after that,
from a movie perspective, there's a reason there's never been an Andrew Johnson movie. Yeah.
Well, there has been. It's just back in the 40s. And it was, really celebratory.
Yeah, and and we're talking back in the 40s, the most popular film in the 40s was Sergeant York. I mean, people don't realize that. It was actually, Sergeant York was like the highest grossing film for like 4 years during the entire war period.
They won't get me. I'll go back in them hills.
You ain't even put hands on your trail in 40, no matter how far back you go.
Then they better not catch up with me, or they'll be a-wishing they hadn't.
York, take over. The only non-com left.
The rest of you, keep under cover.
Come back here. Where are you going?
You didn't give me command.
More than, any of the other great films of that decade, it was Sergeant York, because it was, Gary Cooper was such a huge star. Sergeant York was such a patriotic figure, and the story was, such a carefully made film.
We'll talk more about it. What's the Sergeant York story?
This kind of came out of the fact that Sergeant, Alvin York, was the great World War One hero, had, he was finally was trying to raise money for charity, so he agreed to let Hollywood make a movie based on his story. They cast Gary Cooper, who's probably the second biggest star in Hollywood. They made it in early 1941. It gets released in, I think, December of 1941, right after the war, Pearl Harbor, or right before Pearl Harbor. And the film plays in theaters for basically 3.5 years, top grosser for all 3 years. If you've seen the film, it's actually pretty accurate, specifically during the section where we deal with World War One. They talked about the fact he was constant. He tried to be a conscientious objector. He got convinced finally to go fight. He's from a rural part of Tennessee. Really had no idea what he was getting into. And because he was just a good hunter, and the situation by that point of World War One was so dire on the German side that he just had bad. He's had fantastic luck in capturing so many, Germans. But they also accurately depict it wasn't just him, but he got all the credit. So
that's great.
It's one of the cases where Hollywood actually was pretty accurate. Now they glam it up a little bit, like when he meets, I'm blanking on the senator, but I believe it's Humes, which I went to UT, so all the buildings across the UT are all named after the congressmen and senators from that time period.
Okay, got it. Yeah, well, hey, so we're talking about movies now. Talk about your podcast.
Yes, it's the Good, the Bad, and the Nerdy Movie Podcast. We've been doing it for about a little over a year and a half now. And as the name kind of implies, we review either a movie that's good, a movie that's bad, or a movie that's nerdy. And, you know, I have rotating, you know, guests with me, and we sometimes we'll argue, like, is this a good movie, is it a bad movie, is it a nerdy movie? Sometimes it's pretty obvious what the movie is up front, sometimes it's not. You know, like, recently we did a series on all the Star Wars films, and you know, you would think those are all nerdy. No, there are, some are really good, some are really bad, some are really nerdy for specific reasons. You know, we've done a series, we recently covered films from 1994 specifically, which is one of those years that everyone talks about as one of those great years of movies. And we went through all five films that were nominated for Best Picture, although we've yet to do Pulp Fiction. That's the last one we have yet to do. We discussed how they are in present day, how they look. And then we also looked at other films of that year that kind of show comparisons. Like, for instance, is Ed Wood a better movie than Forrest Gump? In consensus, we seem to all agree we would rather watch Ed Wood more than we would watch Forrest Gump. Actually, we know Forrest Gump was the highest grossing film that year, which is, you know, a rare case where the Oscar winner is the highest grossing film. But, you know, and specifically considering Forrest Gump is a historical film, how accurate is it at some points, and how much of it is more Hollywood trying to romanticize the baby boomer generation?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a funny story, and that there's a Forrest Gump you know, figure going through history, meeting, you know, LBJ and Kennedy and being in the hippie movement and then Nixon and then jogging during the 80s and being part of the fitness craze and all of that.
Yeah, inventing bumper stickers and have a nice day, you know, which also in historically inaccurate. Those, you know, were all invented way before then. It's, you know, the film itself, like, especially when you get to the 70s parts, there's no way Forrest was the one who got the Watergate scandal started, right? By calling the, but, you know, oh, hey, let's throw this in. Hey, let's have him meet John Lennon. Let's have him help him write the song Imagine. You know, it's funny at the time, but it's kind of ridiculous the more you watch it. But I've often praised, you know, the one thing that Gump should get credit for is the sequence in Vietnam, specifically the main battle, because a lot, you know, my uncle fought in Vietnam. He said that's pretty much how it was. Lots of rain, and then suddenly you'd be in a horrible firefight because the sun came out. And, you know, there was, you know, they actually showed how they would do napalm strikes. And, you know, should we point out, 94, you already had a plethora of Vietnam films showing different depictions of it, you know, Platoon showing Oliver Stone's perspective when he fought in Vietnam, Full Metal Jacket, which, you know, gets criticized for its kind of fantasizing way of showing how Tet Finn's offensive was. But then, like my father told me, the section that was entirely at boot camp, that was what he experienced when he was in basic training.
I think you bring up a good point that, even if, and people who like history, and I have this tendency, you know, we'll just like give up on something if there's something wrong. And it's hard. I think, though, you have to open up a little. Like, for instance, not a movie, but the TV show Turn. I just couldn't watch anymore. I'm sorry, because I felt like you're showing Adams as a 25-year-old. The man was like 50 during the events of the revolution. Like, but in other cases, I think, like, I'll give you an example. Hamilton, the musical. I watched that when it became available on the internet. I never could get the Broadway tickets. I used to hover around the theater a little bit and, like, pretend I was going in so I looked cool. I even took a picture that I used for the podcast once with me, and there's Hamilton. But no one could get tickets to that. So, but I finally did see it. And I think that while there are a few things kind of wrong, they're few little things. And some of them have to do with the compression of time, which historians writing large books don't have to worry about. All right. You have to compress time in movies or plays or TV. But then I also feel like the one thing that it adds by the style of presentation is the spirit of the time. The agony that maybe Hamilton felt living like he did is probably best expressed in that kind of form of music, where somebody who's used to like a traditional history presentation is probably like, you know, looking at it and saying, this is all garbage because look, it's rap, and they don't even have rap at that time. So it's ahistorical and it's not, you know what? I'm like, Yeah, but for conveying, say, emotion, you may be using a device such as a history book or a black and white movie or something else that's not correctly conveying the emotion, and he gets it done for you with the actors and their performance.
Yeah.
Another level.
And I've said, if you have issues with Hamilton, watch 1776, and then you get like a more, you know, it's...
Yeah, you'll feel a lot better.
Yeah. It's like 1776 is like, well, some of it's accurate, some of it's just ridiculous. It's watching, you know, Ben Franklin, you know, staying in, you know, tap dance or something should drive you more nuts than watching, you know, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and Hamilton have a rap battle. Because that's actually probably more likely to happen. I don't know. You know, something I always like to bring out is recently when Lincoln came out about 10 years ago, that broke one of the biggest myths about Lincoln, which was, you know, pretty much because of Hollywood, everyone thought Lincoln had a deep voice. And then when we get the, you know, a more historically accurate version of Lincoln played by Daniel Day-Lewis, he's speaking with what most believe is his correct tone, which is light and soft.
Shall we stop this bleeding?
Yeah. Did anyone ever meet anyone from Kentucky or in southern Illinois? Like, what do they think they sound like? And now, you know, for public speaking and politics, there might have been a little bit of effect that one had to be heard. But no, I think most of it's from those, from the movie. Probably
young,
before
Young
that.
Abe Lincoln. Most people say Young Abe Lincoln, which...
Well, you all know I'm just a fresh lawyer trying to get ahead. But some of you boys act like you want to do me out of my first client. I'm not saying you fellas are not right. Maybe these boys do deserve to hang. But with me handling their case, don't look like you'll have much to worry about on that score. All I'm asking is to have it done with some legal pomp and show.
That's right. We've gone to a heap of trouble not to have at least one hanging.
Sure you have, Mac. And if these boys had more than one life, I'd say go ahead. Maybe a little hanging mightn't do them any harm. But the sort of hanging you boys would give them would be so... so permanent. Trouble is, when men start taking the law into their own hands, they're just zapped in all the confusion and fun to start hanging somebody who's not a murderer, somebody who is.
One of those actors specifically would talk in that tone because that's how they talked, and people just assumed that's how it went. And from that point on, no matter what the depiction was, even if it was like Gore Vidal Lincoln with... Sam Waterston, you get that everyone has starts talking with him with this kind of deeper voice, which that wasn't historically accurate. And specifically when we talk about Civil War, Hollywood's influence on how people perceive it is fascinating. You know, on You Must Remember This podcast with Karina Wong, where she talked about how the movie A Birth of a Nation truly triggered why there were so many, you know, mm-hmm. Civil War Confederate memorials. Because mm-hmm. if you look at the time that movie was released and you look at when a lot of those statues were put up, there's a correlation because it was such a huge box office and the film has such a very pro-Confederacy slant that, of course, it would stir up these emotions for people who were not alive about their grandfathers that they never met.
Yeah, and, you know, I think that's totally... Oh, I love the You Must Remember This podcast, by the way. Great, great podcast.
Yeah, if anyone wants to listen about Hollywood history, that is a fantastic podcast to listen to. And, you know, another thing, but as you get into, like, the 60s and 70s, and some would say Vietnam War footage kind of helped influence this, but when you get to, I guess, the term revisionist Western, and it becomes a thing. Now, I always say, and, you know, it's probably because of my love of the film, and it's why my podcast has a name, but The Good and the Bad and the Ugly is the film that I think truly started what I would call a more gritty look at the Civil War period. Even though it's a spaghetti Western, there's this great sequence set at a Civil War battle over a bridge that, you know, it's literally people are dying, they're all sweaty, it's a big old mess. It's not like something you would see in a traditional one with John Wayne, like, or something Disney would produce, because a lot of people forget Walt Disney produced a lot of Civil War era films. So you get something like this, Clint Eastwood's in it, and then after he stops working with Sergio Leone, he starts making his own westerns, which are very dark and gritty. And that kind of becomes great. This whole movement of this of the new dark and gritty, you know, depictions of war and of those time periods. And, you know, I mean...
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that that's it's a great point. It's how it changes. There's no doubt that from Woodrow Wilson said, it's like writing history with lightning. And it's unfortunately set in the wrong context, but it's, you know, sort of supportive of Birth of Nation. There is a little bit of controversy about that. The producer might have run a little bit with Wilson's quote more than he said, but hey, we never know. We, you know, some of that.
Yeah. D.W. Griffin. It's funny. Griffin was accused of being a racist film, which he said he wasn't. But if you watch it, there's very, you know, racist depictions of everything. But there are some very historically accurate depictions, like Lincoln's assassination. What's interesting then is you get the next year he makes a movie, Intolerance, which is this incredibly massive epic about, you know, which includes sections about the Huguenots being massacred, Jesus Christ's, you know, crucifixion, and you get all this, like the Tower of Babel. You get these ridiculously complex historical reenactments. And, you know, he's trying to argue against his views in that film.
I interpreted the Intolerance as it was a counter to the reaction to him, because there was a very aggressive movement. While Birth of the Nation did, you know, unfortunately, really move forward the second Ku Klux Klan, there was an anti-movement. The NAACP was out there. There was boycotts of various movies, particularly in the North. And there was this whole movement against him, particularly in professional Hollywood. And to me, Intolerance just smacks of like a kind of counter tweet or a counter comment on Facebook. It was just like, yeah, you guys are intolerant because you won't accept any other view. And let me show you instances of history. It's cleverly disguised as like, let me show you how bad things happen through history. But I also felt it was kind of like, you people, because another one of the little scenes in Intolerance is the New England mums kind of judging people.
Yeah.
And there you really get the connection between, yes, it's just like that was always the Southerners' view of New England, maybe with some accuracy, you know. They would say boasting Massachusetts, their Puritan values and things. But I always felt that was a little bit of like too much of him. But in the same time, he creates these great movie effects and these wonderful scenes for a horrible thing.
Exactly.
For history, one of the most damaging has always been the scenes, not only in that movie, but in other books and other accounts where the legislatures and the Reconstruction governments, you know, are a bunch of idiots and all of that. And it's all racially motivated, when the evidence says something else, that African-Americans were attempting to start governments and take care of themselves in areas where, in many cases, they had the majority or at least had enough of a voting bloc that with any other group over time, you see that they become part of the establishment. But that wasn't allowed to happen because of the, so that's one of the more tragic scenes when I see that to me, when I watch that, or parts of that.
Yeah. I mean, I've watched it a couple, and I'm a silent film buff. Like, for instance, you watch a movie like The General from Buster Keaton. It's also from the Confederate side, but it's a farce. There's a very accurate like battle sequence, but it's, once again, it's a farce. You know, you're not supposed to take it seriously. But then you get, but when you try to make it like a serious drama, then you get the distortion. And, but, you know, as I point out, but say you get to 1989 when Glory comes out, which is one of the most gritty depictions of the Civil War battles. I've often said, you know, if you want to watch a movie about Civil War, watch Glory. Don't watch Gone with the Wind. Don't watch any of these other, you know, from those periods where they were trying to make it glorious. We need to look at a movie where we show how horrible all the whole conflict was. And I often give credit to, you know, Denzel Washington's performance and, you know, Matthew Broderick's performance. So you get this kind of duality that the film really does a good job depicting, strangely enough. And, you know, I was in high school in the 90s, and they actually would, they had made an edit of that film to show in high schools, which it was a regular thing. You would watch it in high school because it was one of the more grounded versions. And prior to that, when I was in middle school, we'd watch Gone with the Wind, which bored me, and I've always thought it's one. I've always been on the record. I don't like Gone with the Wind. I don't think it's a good movie. I think it's too long and too ridiculous. Yet that was something you'd watch for his for Civil War, you know, lessons. Watch a movie like Glory, which you can't really show at younger ages, but in, maybe in high school level, you get a real grit of like the damage those war, you know, like conflicts were when cannonballs be fired at marching troops. How?
What did you think of Gettysburg?
See, I love half of the film. I do feel like I always feel like they stretch stuff out, but yeah, because yeah. If they chopped it up like they originally discussed, and you know, there's a miniseries version of that and Gods and Generals, which I think actually does better. You need those breaks. It's still very grounded, really good. You know, I've said for Jeff Daniels is fantastic in the film. You know, I like, and I feel like he'd been kind of more of the central figure more than Lee, then you would have gotten a more interesting production. You know, something you really should watch just for the same thing. You get these, there haven't been a lot of Civil War era films pretty much in the last couple of decades. One, they're expensive, but two, it's just like there is some taboo nature to it, but also just the fact of the matter is they used to make Civil War films all the time. Cause just the same thing. They had Western sets and Civil War costumes they just reuse over and over again. Now it's much more expensive to do this kind of thing. You know, the Coen Brothers version of True Grit was far more accurate to the novel, but a lot more expensive than, say, the John Wayne version because you had to have these period-accurate costumes and, you know, that were way more expensive and, you know, ground, you know, grittiness for how everyone's makeup was and how their physical appearances were. But at the same time, it's a fantastic film. And it was a huge hit. So you can make an argument here and there. You can try Civil War era epics or dramas and see what the audience will take. You know, I've said before, the Tombstone, which is a fantastic Western with Val Kilmer as Doc Holliday, one of the best performances ever of the 90s, is fantastic. But then you say the next year when Kevin Costner's Wyatt Earp came out, which was probably more historically grounded, but too much. I always said it's the film that had too much in it. You know, it's like it just drags in certain sections, even though that's an interesting part of Wyatt Earp's story. Do you need it in a film?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so... If and what would you say if you do you have a favorite historical film?
I kind of dance around. Like I said, for instance, I love The General, even though it's not exactly the most historical epic. But for me, I probably have to lean toward either Tombstone or if we're talking more just general history. I love, you know, I love Saving Private Ryan because it's such a fantastic Spielberg film. And there's it's kind of a wide range to when talk to historical accuracy. But personally, and I've done this on the podcast, I think Kingdom of Heaven from Ridley Scott, especially if you see the director's cut, is one of the best films ever about medieval conflict, the conflict going on that's been going on in Israel for several thousand years at this point. And the film, such a great... And if you see the director's cut, which is much longer, includes plot lines they edited it out because they thought the movie was too long, completely, you know, gives a full perspective of how the Crusades were, and such a film. I told everyone, if you want to watch and understand why the Middle East is such a complex story, this movie accurately digs into that. And and that's the one I would probably pick as my favorite historical film at this point.
Yeah, I don't have a lot. I would have to go almost with Lincoln because for politics guy, like for historical politics guys, you don't have a lot. So I'm thinking of Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. I mean, but that's and that shows you a couple things. I think the president of the Senate, the vice president, did fall asleep a lot. I think Lincoln, at least showing you a political battle live, whether there are some inaccuracies or not, showing you a political battle and showing you Congress and making that exciting. People needed to see, like, it's not so easy. You have to, like, sway people to your cause. And
yeah, Spielberg famously, when he hired Tony Kushner to write the screenplay, it was like... massive, like, and then he said, just cut it down to this particular story. He said, that's the story we should tell. They trimmed it drastically down, and that's what the movie got. So, you know, that's an example. You have the right director and the right screenwriter working together with the right actor. Kara, but thanks for having me on.
Oh, same here. Thanks so much.
Yeah, and for, you know, like I said, let me just do one more plug. It's the Good, the Bad, and the Nerdy Movie Podcast. You can find us on almost any platform at this point.
Okay, great.
Thanks.
Thanks, Tom.
I want to thank Kevin Willis and Tom Morris, and I want to thank you for listening. The website is myhistorycanbeatupyourpolitics.com. We do have a Patreon at patreon.com/MHCBUYP. We have a special episode there, Draft Johnson, about Johnson and the 68 convention. We are going to play at the end of August, but if you can't wait, go to Patreon now and get it. Thanks for listening.
My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a historian, professor, and the creator of History That Doesn't Suck, a podcast that provides a complete overview of U.S. history through storytelling, yet keeps the rigor you'd expect in a university class. Starting with 22-year-old George Washington in his first battle, join me for a chronological telling of the United States' story, its unlikely revolution, fractious civil war, tenacious inventors, brave reformers, and more. With more than 100 episodes, you can already binge listen your way through the progressive era. Find History That Doesn't Suck wherever you get your podcasts.